This is a recording of the experiences and reminiscences of Florence Palmer, retired missionary from India. The interviewer is Betty Turnell, and the narrator is Miss Palmer. The recording is being made at the request of the United Methodist Women of the First United Methodist Church in Decatur, Illinois, at the home of Miss Palmer, apartment 4, 225 West William Street in Decatur, on May 19th, 1983. Well, Miss Palmer, I'm going to call you Florence because we're good friends. Florence, can you tell us something about your experiences as a missionary in India?
I would be happy to, and perhaps you too might have the question in mind, how did you happen to become a missionary, and why would you choose India in the first place? It was not just a happening, but nor was it a traumatic experience. It was more like the unfolding of a dream. From the early background of missionary education in the Methodist Church at Carthage, Illinois, where there were mission study groups for all ages, and particularly the standard bearers of high school ages, interest grew. The standard bearers were supporting a Bible woman in India. Our church supported a missionary couple serving in India. Also, a single lady, member of the church, became a missionary to India. When these missionaries came home on furlough, they made India come alive. So, India was the first country I thought of as my goal for missionary service. After teaching 4 years in Decatur, and after acceptance through the regular channels for missionary service, the time for departure came in October 1930. 13 new missionaries, with 3 older missionaries returning from furlough, left New York together. Only 4 of us, with the 3 older missionaries, were together all the way to India. On the 28th day after leaving New York, we were awakened in the early morning hours by all the excitement of sighting the coastline of India. As the ship approached the harbor, the eastern sky became a blaze of colors, blended into a fiery red as the sun began to rise, palm trees in silhouette against that eastern sky. This was really India. At that time, the fastest train going up country met the ship at the harbor. The American Express took care of the luggage, and we were soon settled into a second-class women's compartment and on our way. What an exciting 8 hours from Bombay to Baroda, about 300 miles. I and 2 of the older missionaries were the only ones of our group on this train to Baroda. The day soon passed into evening, as it was first on one side and then to the other all day, to watch the passing scenes of people, animals, fields, villages, and mud huts. Then the vendors with hot tea, fruits, snacks, who ran up and down the train each time it stopped. In the early evening, Baroda Station came into view. The annual conference was in session in Baroda. Therefore, a large group had come to the station to meet this new missionary. All I could say was, "Salam, salam." I was soon whisked off in a car to the bungalow, where several of the teachers were waiting to dress me in a bright-colored sari and put bangles on my arms. And we were on our way to the district superintendent's house, where a real Gujarati dinner was served to all the conference members. Sitting on the floor, pillows for me, we were soon served on a leaf plate, a sweet ball, rice and curry, hot with spices, but good. There was no silverware, but eating with our fingers. Someone pushed a banana over to me, nice and cooling after hot spices. The second day was the reception for the bishop, with the special entertainment being a ride on this huge elephant. What an experience to climb up onto the platform with our feet hanging over the edge, ducking our heads to avoid the tree branches. We were swaying in a rhythm reminding me of the recent ocean waves. I was ready to get down after the 5-minute ride. The conference business sessions were interesting, but when would I ever be able to understand the language? The appointments always came at the close of the last session of conference. I heard my appointment to read, appointed to language study. Language school began the next week, an interdenominational school for all new missionaries within the state of Gujarat. In addition to the regular classes, individual lessons with Indian pundits in the early morning and again in the evening hours kept us busy. I became aware of the fact that the grammatical structure was almost identical to that of Latin. 8 years of Latin study plus 4 years of teaching Latin gave a wonderful background and foundation for the Gujarati language. But pronunciation is always a problem. There were many teachers while playing badminton with the teachers or walking with some of the girls, visiting in the homes and so forth, all eager to hear me speak in Gujarati. After the regular oral and written exams, I began the second year of study together with the appointment to part-time work in the villages. The first visits to the villages were most interesting, for here is where the greater number of the population lived and still do today. This was real India. People, dogs, mud huts with doors opening out onto the dusty road. All most interesting, but also very frustrating because of the language. No one else in the village spoke English. I had to make an effort to express myself. I began to write out what I wanted to say to the women, as well as to the people in an evening meeting, and my Bible woman would listen to me correcting my mistakes, a very patient teacher. Village responsibility meant visiting in the homes, inspecting the elementary schools under our supervision, and to my dismay, giving attention to all the sick. I determined that a very necessary part of my equipment must be a medicine box. Our missionary doctor in Baroda prepared such a box, including a handbook of instructions for the common lay person. Malaria fever was always present. Colds, sore eyes, all kinds of sores, aches and pains. For those who needed a doctor and hospital care, I would write a note for them to take to one of the mission hospitals. The evening meetings were for showing pictures on the life of Christ, on various health problems, on child care, and sanitation in general. This through the use of a magic lantern, a pressure lamp with the necessary attachments. There was no electricity. It was not uncommon for the whole village to come together for these night meetings. It offered opportunity to distribute literature and Christian gospel portions. Among some of the most interesting and special privileges of village work, I would mention these in particular. There was a visit in the homes of the village leaders, always of high caste. Then the contact with educational officers in the district, for they were responsible for visiting our mission schools and assessing government grants. All schools meeting the government standards of teacher qualifications, daily attendance, course of study, and so forth, received substantial grant and aid from government. It was then necessary to have periodical teacher institutes. Then there were the institutes for village pastors and their wives, always teaching. There were the institutes for recognized village leaders among the women, even though they might be illiterate, and most of them were. The village women's institutes really became one of the most rewarding experiences I had. The pastor, or circuitdar, having supervision over 10 or 12 villages, would give a list of names of women whose husbands would be willing for them to come to a central village center for a week, as well as the willingness of the women. A group of 20 or 25 village women and the babies whom the fathers could not care for at home would come to the circuit center, where a church building, a pastor's house, a well, and usually an enclosed compound were available. Here we were only women. A cook was hired and someone to care for the small babies, and the women had nothing else to do except to sit together for study, for craft work, for playing games and eating, and drawing the necessary water for daily use. They had never had such an opportunity before. They could now sit with their faces open and sing and recite. Eager to learn, they had good memories. Adult literacy was introduced, the first time many of them had ever taken a slate pen in hand and tried to write what they saw on the chart. But most of them could at least write their names before they went home. They would take a colorful picture to hang on the mud wall, or perhaps a paper cross, which would help them remember their daily prayers. But most of all, their enthusiasm to learn, which was evident to their husbands. And sometimes when we met, they would ask when their wives would be called to the next school. Sometimes classes for continued adult literacy were arranged where women of several villages could come together. The government gave the incentive for adult literacy classes by offering a substantial bonus in salary to the regular school teachers based upon the number of women passing a government exam. Can you imagine what joy and pride a newly literate woman would have as she stood before a gathering, reading aloud whatever her assignment might be? The Vishwa Dharma Niketan, an ashram of the world religion, offered a unique opportunity to become aware of the trend among a few high-caste Hindus toward modern Hinduism. A group of young Hindu men, sometimes their wives also, began searching the scriptures of some of the main religions, such as Hinduism, the Muslim religion, or Islam, Parsi, and now the Christian religion, and for the first time began reading the Bible. We gave them several copies of the Bible to add to their library in the ashram. Their leader had renounced idol worship and had even broken down idols of a Hindu temple in which he himself had been the priest. Premal Maharaj and several followers read the Bible through, and especially the New Testament, several times. whenever we itinerated in that area, we had opportunity to meet with them in their ashram and discuss together some of their questions concerning the Christian faith. The last 3 years of service in India, before returning to USA for retirement, gave me a very different challenge. Through the years, I had recognized the need for bringing together educated young Christian women who were already serving the church in various ways to give them opportunity for an interchange of thoughts and study, and perhaps more specific study. So a program for women's leadership training in the various areas of India was prepared by a central committee for the All India Women's Work Committee of the Central Conference in India. Women leaders of other than the Methodist Church were added to the Central Committee. India was divided into four areas. This meant several different languages. Therefore, we planned for only those women who could speak and read fluently in English would be invited to these seminars. Through correspondence with the different denominational leaders in a particular area, a list of women was made and a location for 30 or 35 women was chosen, usually where a college or at least high school would offer the convenience for lodging and food. The staff for these seminars were for the most part college professors who gave their services for that particular time. There were discussion periods when each one freely expressed her own opinions and ideas. Among the subjects chosen were comparative religions, the basic ideas, Bible study, evangelism, women's opportunity for service within her own church. Four such seminars were held, and from reports received, some areas held similar seminars for women in their own areas. As many of the women expressed, this was just like having a refresher college course. And so it proved to be most worthwhile. As time for my departure from India drew near, it was necessary to find an Indian woman who would continue in this kind of leadership. One such was found, most capable and experienced, from her years of being principal of high schools, then of an intermediate college, and teacher training department, and as a member of several All India boards. Because it would be an All India appointment, she received the necessary approval of the Council of Bishops in India and received her appointment. This program still continues, though in a somewhat different pattern. This is only a glimpse of some of the experiences during the 38 years of service in India.
Florence, that was a fascinating account of your experiences in India, and I'm sure that everyone will agree that you not only did a tremendous service for the church and for the people of India, but you probably got quite a good deal out of it yourself. So,
I often say that we really receive more ourselves than we think we are giving to the people. It's so rewarding to have the privilege of being in the midst of another culture and learning with them.
Well, it's nice to have something of that sort work both ways, and we really admire you and appreciate all that you did. Now, as one of your listeners to this account, I have a few questions that I wonder if you could answer, a little follow-up points, because we know that this country is so vast and so different from the United States that naturally I'm sure everyone has questions about India. Going back to the your early experiences, when you first decided to go there, I wonder what the reaction of your family was.
They naturally thought of India as being away over there on the other side of the world, and so were not really too happy about my going. However, they made no objection whatever, so I felt perfectly free in continuing my plan and desire to go to India. In fact, they took me to the New York harbor. We were together on the ship. They met me at the time of my first furlough, and from then on, when they realized I was still just a person when I came home on furlough, it didn't make any difference after the first experiences.
When they saw that things were working out very well.
That's
for
right.
You.
When I was still like a human being. I think they thought I would be quite different when I came home, but I don't know really what they expected.
Of course, as you said, you taught 4 years before you went,
yes.
And so you weren't exactly just a teenager when you left.
I did teach 4 years, and then at that time, you had to be 25 years of age before you could be accepted. I did teach until I was 26 when I went out to India.
So you were really quite mature in your thinking, so your family could understand that you really knew what you were doing.
Yes,
right?
I think they were.
Did you have to have any special training in this country before you went there? You did have a training period after you got there, didn't you?
We did not have to have any particular training before we left. We were supposed to be a college graduate. This was one requirement of the Board of Missions. There was no specific training as far as special subjects were concerned. They encouraged us to think of the special training after we had been on the field and come home on furlough. This is where we would take a year of special training. For instance, my first furlough, I began on my master's degree in Christian education and started up at Garrett Theological School in Evanston, which also gave opportunity to have some educational courses at Northwestern.
How long were these furloughs?
That depended. The normal furlough would be 1 year. During the war time, it had to be according to whenever a ship was available that would take women. But the normal period of furlough would be 1 year.
You did get your master's degree?
Not the first furlough, but Northwestern and Garrett were willing to hold over the previous studies, and Skerritt College in Nashville, Tennessee, accepted the credits which Northwestern and Garrett had given. So I got my master's degree from Skerritt College in Nashville.
Very good. Well, you told us where you were stationed in India, but India is such a big country, I don't think you told us where it is, what area and so on. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
The whole country of India is divided into perhaps 25 native states today, one of which is Gujarat. And Baroda, B-A-R-O-D-A, is one of the larger cities within this smaller state of Gujarat, which is located 300 miles north of Bombay along the western coast.
What was the climate there?
We were more in a temperate climate. However, that meant that your summer weather could get as hot as 120, and the winter time cold weather would be 50 or 60, because there was no central heat, no heat except the sun. When it was too cold and damp for the school children to sit in an enclosed building, they would go out and sit under the trees where it was much more comfortable outside.
Did you have any health problems there?
I was one of the very fortunate ones. I did have a bout or two of malaria, which was so very common at that time. Now, it's very seldom even heard of. They have done a wonderful job in eradicating malaria, smallpox, and some of those earlier terrible diseases that India was raging with. I can remember when I was filling in as hostel superintendent during one period of time when a missionary was home for health reasons. We would have a room full of 20, 25 girls, all with high fevers. At that time, the best remedy was just to keep them wrapped in cold cloths. Well, that kept a number of people busy all the time trying to bring their fevers down.
It sounds as if you had a short course in medicine in order to help these people.
I soon found that out in India, and I think the common opinion among particularly the village people was anybody with a white skin ought to be able to heal or to tell what's wrong with a sick person.
Would be a doctor.
Should be a doctor or a nurse.
You talked a little bit about language. Now, this language you learned and became fluent in was only one of the languages of India.
This is what makes India so divided in its peoples and forms of government, and culture also is quite different. For India does have 15 major languages. That means each one of the major languages could be divided into hundreds of dialects that are spoken by people who are far away in the villages. They have no direct contact with city people, so they just get a mixture of languages that becomes their unwritten language. Now, I, for one period of time, was working among the so-called tribal peoples, the aborigines, so to speak, of India. Theirs was a grand mixture of Hindi, Gujarati, and it meant that I always had to depend upon the pastor, who usually was with me in a village, to interpret for me.
You mentioned that English was a language you used at these seminars. Is English a common language in India?
It was very common all through those early years when the English were ruling India, for that was their basic language in school. They began even down in the primary sections. So the earlier, older students in private schools, in colleges, all had a good basic foundation of English. However, there became the time when the national movement was so strong that English was forbidden in the schools, and therefore there has been that lapse through the years. But now there is a tendency to go back, and I think in most of the accredited schools, English is now again being taught in the lower standards schools.
You told us something about the people of India, but do you want to tell us a little more about your impressions of the people there?
One of my early impressions when I first began visiting in the villages was there was no people on earth who could be more hospitable than the village people. All you had to do was to just be patient with them. If you would go to the door and just make yourself known, a woman would be very skeptical until she would see who you were, and if she recognized, which she did, the pastor, and of course the Bible woman with me, each of them could speak fluently. So that was a point of getting closer to them. And then I think the thing that counts most, particularly in the villages among the people, is if you accept a cup of tea or just break off a little crust of the freshly baked bread, then you're a one of the family. So it didn't take me long to do that, because I did like tea and I loved their village breads.
So then you were accepted.
Then I was really accepted.
You talked a little bit about the place of women in India. You mentioned these seminars where the women, or the meetings where the women could come if their husbands gave approval. Now, of course, that gives us a clue. How did most men regard women?
Of course, it's the man who's the head of the household, whether it's in the villages or in the cities. So it would be the men of the family who would have to take the responsibility of the women when the women would come to these village institutes or seminars. This was not so true among the high caste women who were more educated and had taught in places of responsibility. But as far as the village women were concerned, once the women had come to an institute and they had gone home and their husbands had seen the difference it made in the openness of their women, they were very happy to have them called 2-3 times. It was difficult to give all of the village women, which of course was never quite possible, an opportunity to come to the village institutes. Now, for the seminars, that would be quite a different picture, because these were educated women. They were in responsible positions, both in the church and many of them in government service. So there was no question as to their own opinions would be accepted.
Please reverse the cassette to side B. Of course, we know from the fact that the Prime Minister of India is a woman that certainly the educated women, people at the top have privileges that I'm sure the village women don't have. When you talked about these meetings of the village women, you mentioned that they were so happy to have their faces open, which tells us something, doesn't it, about their ordinary life.
That's true, because if their husbands had been present, they would have had to cover their faces. This would just mean pulling their sari over their face. And, of course, with just women sitting together as women, they could sit perfectly free. They wouldn't even have to have their sari over their heads. Mm-hmm. But the minute they go out of their own homes in a village where they live, they must have their heads covered and their faces covered partially, particularly if there are any men coming directly toward them.
You mentioned that they dressed you in Indian fashion. What kind of clothes did you wear most of the time?
Out in the villages, I very commonly wore just a common sari, because it meant while speaking with the women, visiting in their homes, I would be sitting on the floor with the women. It would either be that or sitting on a low rope bed, so you would need your legs covered. It would be very indecent in a village culture to expose your legs, especially, up to your knees. So it was most convenient to just wear a sari, where you would always be accepted, and you could easily move about on the floor with a sari on, not have to be so particular about your legs.
They're beautiful, really, the material and the flowing lines and so on. Are they as comfortable as they look?
They really are comfortable, and I didn't even mind them during the hot, sticky weather, because they sort of serve as a cooling effect. Gujarat is famous for its cotton saris, because one of the main crops is cotton. So we have, I think, within the total state, there has been at least 120 or 25 cotton mills. This means that our cotton is very common in the little shops, even in the villages. You can always buy lovely cotton saris.
You mentioned when you took your first train trip in India that you went into a second-class carriage. That shows that there is a class distinction in India?
That's right. And I think this is, in fact, I know it still is true today, where your train is one car after the other, one not connected with the other, and there are three classes: first class, second class, third class. There are compartments for just women in each of these classes. Third class means just board benches, but there's where you meet the people. And often, if I were just traveling on a small, short time, I would go third class, because then you have free conversation with the women as they would get on and off at the village stations. Second class is for those who can afford the difference and in price of your ticket. You would have leather-covered benches, really, with a lower and upper berth. If you were traveling for overnight, you made your reservation for a second-class berth. First class was for those who could still pay a larger sum for your ticket, and you had more convenience in the toilet arrangement and in the class of, you could have a small coupe by yourself if you were riding first class for just the women's compartment.
Did you notice a class distinction in other places other than trains in general life?
Of course, in the villages, there's caste distinction everywhere. Our village work, our Christian work, was commonly among the lower caste people, which meant that their houses were off to one side of the village, while the caste groups, perhaps there would even be a road, or there might even be a field that would divide the sections between the low and the high caste peoples in India. In a city, it's not so distinguishable, though it is there, where a low caste section would be quite separate from the high caste section.
You mentioned something about the food. Was all the food you ate Indian, and did you like it?
I have always liked Indian food from that very first meal. It was not our practice to eat all the time with the village pastors. In one instance, it would mean that they would go to extra trouble and go to extra expense to give you special food. They wouldn't give you just their common, ordinary, daily food. So it was our custom to for us to take our grain and our vegetables with us and to do our own cooking as we traveled in the villages.
What kind of accommodations did you have in your living from day to day at the place where you lived?
In Baroda, which was one of our larger mission stations, single missionaries, lived together in a large bungalow, brick, where our bedrooms were on the top floor, and offices and general living and eating arrangements were on the lower floor, so that the one building served as office and a place of residence as well. When I first went to India, there were four of us living in the bungalow together. That depends on how many missionaries are living in a station. The couples would have their own bungalow available. The doctor and nurses would have their own medical bungalow, which was attached to the hospital.
After all, the word bungalow is Indian, isn't it? We have bungalows in our country, but they came from India, didn't they?
I think they perhaps earlier came from England.
Really?
Where a bungalow is attached even to a little small house. I think it has a little to do maybe with the pattern of a structure. I'm not quite sure where that bungalow came from, but you never would hear the word house commonly spoken.
You talked a little bit about the religions in India, and you used a word that I wasn't familiar with, ashram. What does that mean?
An ashram really means a place of rest. So religious leaders have formed the pattern. I'm not acquainted with the original idea of an ashram, of a place apart from the daily life of the village or the city, where they could go, where their followers could come, and they could sit in quiet and meditate and have their prayers together. And in the ashram, in Jambusar, shall I introduce that? Mm-hmm. J-A-M-B-U-S-A-R one of our larger circuit centers, there was this very fine, it was a separate house where no one actually lived, but where they came together for their study of the various religions. The real intent was for these young minds to call from Hindu religion, from the Muslim religion, from the Parsi religion, and from the Christian religion, what they thought they could put together as a world religion where mm-hmm. all peoples would accept the beliefs.
Did all religions accept so readily this interdenominational situation? Did all of the religions contribute to that? Or was it just few people? It sounds as if it was interdenominational.
No, it really wasn't. It was just these few Hindu people who somewhere along the line had the vision of idol worship being wrong and a Hindu temple which has so many terrible features about it. When I say that, I'm thinking in particular of the sacrifices that a Hindu makes when they go to certain temples. It is really hideous, and yet it's always been a very important part of the Hindu religion. But here was a group of people who were beginning to feel that much of that was not a religion. It belonged in another category, and particularly this one religious leader who had the courage to show by demonstrating his own feelings in tearing down the idols that were in his own temple and worshiping, still a Hindu, but a very modern view that accepted beliefs of other people other than just those within the Hindu religion.
But this group was probably relatively small in
they
relation to the
small
larger
group.
Yes.
And I think they probably took this from some of the principles of Mahatma Gandhi, who, of course, did not believe in caste distinctions of any kind. He himself was a Hindu and a high caste Hindu, but he never kept himself away from the low caste. In fact, it was through his efforts and public appearances, teachings, wherever he went, that all castes should be one. And in his public meetings, he would ask the low caste people to come to the front, and the low and the high caste people could move to the back of the gathering in a village group.
He was really an inspiration to them then.
He really was.
Now, how strong are Christians in India?
The Christian group is considered among the minority, considering the large number, which of course is that of Hinduism. The second largest is of the Muslim religion. And the other religions, Parsi, Jainism, Christianity, and many, many other branches of each of these are included among the minority. It is really a very small proportion of the total population of India. Among these, I think the Methodist Church has the largest number of Christians. And we certainly do have the largest number of outstanding Christian leaders, perhaps due to our very organization itself, which picks out leadership of bishops. And then you have your district superintendents and your circuit dars and then your village pastors.
You mentioned a word that I don't believe is in common use, itinerate. We could probably guess what it means, but maybe you could explain a little more about what that is.
Itinerating is a word that I think is very common in India. It means just moving about from one place to another. And as a part of our responsibilities, each time we came home on furlough, we were obligated, but it also was a privilege, to itinerate, to move around among all of the churches within a particular area, especially the area that was taking the greater responsibility for your support in India.
We know you had furloughs to come to the United States, as you say, for study and I'm sure some recreation and getting acquainted with your family again and all of that. But you did have some holidays or furloughs in India too, didn't you? Did you travel much there?
It did give opportunity because of the weather conditions. When during the summertime, which would be the latter part of May, June particularly, you would have very high temperatures up to, say, 120 or so. And that meant that for continued study, for opportunity to meet with other groups, to attend conferences and things of this nature after our regular language school, we would go to the mountain stations. A station would mean a whole town arrangement up in the mountains. Too high for a railway to reach the top where you lived, but you would go up as high as the railroad went, and then you would get out and in some of the areas, there would be roads for buses to go farther than the train could go, but you would finally have to get out and walk the last little distance. That meant that you had to put your luggage on the backs of coolies and you would finally arrive at your destination. During the summertime, we usually had one place where we ate our food. That was our boarding arrangement. And then we would have another place, just small cottages, where maybe two or three of you would plan to spend the summer together, and that's where we would live. If we wanted to do our own cooking, we would have that arrangement too.
So it was a recreation and a rehabilitation from your regular duties.
That's right. And we were supposed to have a month away from our station responsibilities. This was one of the regulations. In fact, our Board of Missions was so insistent upon this that if we became ill, they would ask when we had our last vacation. So it was a part of the total health measures to keep us healthy and well.
Very good. When you came back to the United States after your retirement, did you have any difficulty readjusting to life here?
Probably the greatest difficulty was just in learning to speak English in proper form again. And then, there were many changes, of course, during a period of 5 years, which was the normal term of service on the field, before 1 year of furlough at home. Perhaps the greatest change was in what had taken place commonly, even in transportation. Cars. Everybody had a car. All colors of the world. I can still remember my first impression of being up high in a hotel and looking down upon a parking lot, and I was amazed at the variety of colors of cars. Well, of course, that was just one little thing. I still love to go into a supermarket and am amazed at the food that you buy that is so little to effort, with little effort you can have a meal. But I always enjoy picking out new foods, new products that are frozen, and what you can do with them.
Have you ever gone back to India since you retired?
No, I haven't. It's been in my thinking, but I just... I think one reason is perhaps financial, and then, two, the living conditions in India are quite different. When a national woman is in charge of a whole bungalow, no more missionaries there in Baroda, where I was living. And it's a great strain, really, upon them to take care of foreigners coming and going. Now, if you're in a larger city like Bombay, Delhi, Calcutta, there would be quite a different opinion because we have tourist homes or vacation homes where you could go and pay a certain amount and have your food and lodging.
Do you keep in touch by letter and other means with the people that you knew there?
I'm still making the effort. And we do exchange Gujarati letters, particularly at Christmas time, but there are a few friends in Gujarat who still remember even my birthday. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who want to keep their touch with English, so they write me in English, and I usually try to answer them in Gujarati, in spite of the mistakes.
Very good. How does the United Methodist Church assist retired missionaries? They do make some provision, don't they?
Yes, they do. And our women's division in particular has been very thoughtful all through the years in planning ahead for pensions for all retired missionaries and deaconesses. This means that They have an overall fund, the interest of which is used for the payment of pension, and the pensions are based upon a set of regulations which the Women's Division has made for us according to the number of years that you have spent. If you have spent in a foreign country at least 20 years, You have the privilege of retirement in one of our very fine retirement homes, one of which is located in Asheville, North Carolina, where there are presently perhaps as many as 150 or so, there may be more today, residents, and where there is an all-complete availability of care that you might need the rest of your life. There is the residence hall, which means you can live in one room and you use the bath with the resident of the adjoining room. And have the privilege of the dining room, plus little kitchenette, plus your laundry, which can be done for you if you're not able to do it yourself. Or in Asheville, we have the apartment arrangements, which is a separate unit, though joined with the regular main building. Then I think one of the most conveniences that we have is that of a full-fledged hospital, not with a resident doctor, but with resident nurses. And if you are not able to live in a room or in an apartment, you can have the privilege of living in the infirmary, even though you may be able to still walk around and enjoy the privilege of of outside activities that are regulated for your health purposes, but you still have the medical care night and day. You are under supervision of nurses in the residence hall. If the night nurse should be walking along the hallway and seeing your light on, she might knock on your door and ask if you're all right. So you feel that you have constant care there.
It's good to know that the church really appreciates your service. Did you have something more to add?
I was just going to add that we do have another home in California, which is quite a different pattern, and I'm not so familiar with it since it has changed its pattern within recent years. I think they still have the cottage arrangement as well as the residence in the main hall, but they do not have the infirmary arrangement that North Carolina has. Another addition to North Carolina situation is a whole unit for physical therapy, and that is beautifully equipped with modern conveniences for those who need most any type of therapeutical help. And I think one of the attractions there is the very location among the foothills of the Smokies, with an open roof, well, it's really after the pattern of a roof garden over the newest unit. It's fully carpeted, and you can sit out there for a little tea in the afternoon of your own with umbrellas and tables and chairs and so forth, and flower boxes all the way around.
Well, it sounds delightful, and I'm sure these retired missionaries and deaconesses have really earned all of this, and it's good to know that the church does appreciate the work that has been done. And Florence, we too appreciate what you have done, and your experiences as you've related them here are really fascinating, and we thank you very much for sharing it with us. So we do thank you again.
I was very happy to do it. Thank you.
You have been listening to the reminiscences of Florence Palmer as she reflects on her 38 years as a United Methodist missionary in India. And this is Betty Trunell speaking for the United Methodist Women.